Success stories and interviews with game changers and thought leaders who have overcome both in life and in business. Welcome to Vertical Momentum.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I got you.
Hey, guys. Welcome to another episode of Vertical Momentum. I am your host, Richard Kaufman, also known as the Comeback Coach. Guys, this is going to be an episode where you're going to hear some people laugh, some people cry. This is going to be a very emotional episode, but a very learning episode. This is going to be part three of a series called A Soldier Story, and is with my friend and brother, Jody Stubbs. But first, I want to thank our sponsor. If you guys love coffee as much as I do, there's a young lady, military veteran, has a company called Soldier Girl Coffee. I drink her coffee every single day. Check them out. She also have started a brand new product, coffee product with CBD infusion for people that want to relax and people that need to chill out. I don't use that one, but I use the regular one. So definitely check out Soldier Girl Coffee. Guys, this is going to be, like I said, a great episode with a friend of mine. We weren't friends in the military as much, but we became better friends after the military. And he's been through some struggles, but he's had some tragedies. But now he's coming through with some triumphs. It's my friend Jody. Brother, how are you doing today?
Man, I'm absolutely fabulous. I'm enjoying life these days. And how are you, brother? How are you been? How have you been the last couple weeks?
Ever since I had that talk with Brendan, things have started to change for me better mentally, because I felt a lot of shame knowing that I'm the one that should have got hit that day in the helmet, because I'm the one that should have been in the hatch, and he got hit instead. So I lived for like 20 years dealing with that. But once we talked about it, he kind of lifted it off my heart where I'm not feeling that pain anymore. So it's been very enlightening and pretty life-changing just talking to somebody, you know?
Yes, sir. I understand completely.
So, you know, tell us your story. You know, I wanted people to know your backstory. So tell us, where were you born? Where were you raised? And what kind of little boy was Jody?
Okay. I was born in a little town called Laurinburg, North Carolina. Raised in McCall, South Carolina, an even littler town. And I still live in McCall today. I was the third of four kids. I had parents who, you hear a lot of talk about the parents of old. My parents were strict. They were church going people and they were hardworking people. Both of them. My dad just recently retired about 5 years ago when he turned 70. He would have worked longer if he could have, but he's the only man I know that had open heart surgery, triple bypass, and was back at work in 3 weeks. So that kind of tells you what kind of tough man he was. He was also a Marine.
Okay. But, he was a Marine, huh?
Yeah, he was a Marine. He actually served during the Vietnam era. But back then, you know, rules were a lot different, and he had a brother that was already in Vietnam, so he wasn't allowed to go. And then his time was up, and he says he tried to go, and he wanted to go, but his time was up, and he was in love with my mama at the time, and so things just got where he just went ahead and got out. But they raised us, when I say strict, I mean – we done what they told us to in their house. You know what I mean, brother?
Oh,
it was
never too early for an ass whipping, right?
That's right. Hey, we're going to teach you with our words, or we'll teach you with the belt if you don't listen to our words. But
now, were you good in school? Were you a good student?
I wouldn't say that. My mama swears that I had good grades, but I don't see any report cards to back up any of that talk. But no, I wasn't I made honor roll a few times during the years, but I was mostly an ABC student. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I had my strong points and I had my weak points. I was terrible at math, but I was good at science. I was great at spelling, but I was terrible at language or English arts, ELA. But I was, you know, I was a happy kid. I had a brother. He was 6 years older. My baby brother was 6 years younger, but my sister was just 15 months older. So me and her were closer. But we grew up in a small town, a real tight-knit family, a tight-knit church family, a tight-knit school family. So I had a good childhood overall.
So
I can't complain very much.
So tell me about your recruiting story to go into the military.
Okay. I watched my oldest brother. He attempted to go into the military, and he failed out because he had his hearing wasn't up to par. And you know the war stories of guys who miss out, and this one won't take you, but you can always find another one. But he was set on going into the Air Force, and he couldn't make it, so he just kind of gave up his hope of the military. So when it come my time, I remember in high school taking the ASVAB, but I didn't want to go directly out of high school. I wanted to go to a trade school and see what I could do there first before I went in the military. So I joined the delayed entry program. Graduated in 91, and I wasn't going to go until 1992. And then I changed my mind again and put it off again, and I didn't go until 93. I actually joined the United States Navy. So in September 93, I shipped to Great Lakes, Illinois. I think it got about 10 degrees around mid-October, and it stayed there or below all the way through December 23rd when I come home.
Yeah.
Man, it was cold. It gets cold and snowing. Illinois. It's not South Carolina. You know what I'm saying, brother?
Yeah.
So,
now, how many years did you do in the Navy?
I was an engineer working in the main boiler room, main engine room. I wanted to be a boiler technician, but I was still young and wet behind the ears, and I was realizing that the military takes up a lot of your time away from home. And I was freshly married in 1994, my first wife, and we got eloped. And 4 days later, I was in the North Atlantic heading towards Israel and doing a Mediterranean cruise, is what the Navy likes to refer to them as. That's where we hit different ports over in Western Europe. We Spain, Italy, Israel, bunch of different ports back and forth. But you know, I had a good time. I met some good people. I met some lifelong friends. I'm still friends with quite a few people from the ship that I served on, the USS Nassau LHA-4, which was we were a marine hauler, basically. We were like a mini aircraft carrier, the second largest type of ship in the fleet at the time. And I had a ship's crew of about 1,000 with the capability of carrying between 1,200 and 1,500 Marines with us. So we were a pretty big ship. Even at times we carried some SEAL teams, dropped them off in places. I can't tell you what they were doing. I can only tell you that we stopped for a day or two and they'd be gone and then they'd come back.
So how many years did you do in the Navy?
I did 2 years active duty, and I decided it wasn't for me. I didn't like living in Norfolk, Virginia, which is where I was stationed. It was just too busy, too congested, and at the time of my enlistment coming up, our ship was in dry dock doing major overhaul repairs, so I just decided I'm going to get out. And so 1995, I was out of the Navy, separated. They put me on inactive reserve to finish my contract, which ran into July of 2001. And so they sent me my discharge papers and all that. And then, of course, 9/11 happened, and me, like so many other people, and I know a bunch of guys that you talked to, or, you know, they were out in the military and they wanted to come back in. They wanted to serve their country. And I felt the same way, brother. I felt like I still was young enough and I still owed it to my country to defend her. So I rejoined back in the South Carolina National Guard.
Now, did you have to go through basic training and all that again, or did you just have to go through AIT?
Just had to go through AIT, which I don't think was 3 weeks, maybe something like that. And went out to Boise, Idaho for my AIT training. I actually done it, and when we got mobilized for Noble Eagle back in 2002, I know you remember, you and Brendan, that covered pretty good time on that, but that was when I did my AIT. I'd already been on the tank and done a gunnery downrange before I'd finished AIT, so... I don't know. Could I say that? We might have to delete that part.
This is all live, brother. We ain't deleting nothing. This is just the way it is.
The Army may not like that, but that's the way it was in the National Guard. You know how it was in our time.
So now talk to us about your experience with Noble Eagle.
Okay. I was, if you remember, we had troops in out Fort Jackson, which is where you were saying, I believe,
yep,
correct?
Fort Jackson. Relax.
We had Action Jackson. Then we had a group sent out to Fort Gordon, which is in Georgia, right down I-20. I was at Fort Stewart with the command circle that was running the whole Noble Eagle thing. And it was only approximately 35, 40 Joes, and the rest were officers. And we were all there, and I was working with the command center. So I was working directly for Sergeant Alan Bibbert. I don't know if you remember him, Sergeant First Class Bibbert.
No, I don't remember him.
He was, he was one of my first platoon commanders, platoon sergeants, and a great guy, wonderful guy. That's pretty much where I got my taste of learning the ropes and everything from Sergeant Bibbert. Sergeant Michael Wins was there. Sergeant Rusty McKenzie, who is just, I mean, Rusty McKenzie is just my idol, the greatest guy that I ever worked with. And also Sergeant Major Ellington, if you remember Mike Ellington.
Oh, yeah, he was great. And I loved Rusty also. I think Rusty was great people.
Yeah, Rusty's a great guy. But and then after 3 or 4 months, they took Sergeant – well, he was Sergeant First Class Ellington at the time. He took a group and moved out to Fort Benning, Georgia, which is further southwest Georgia. And so we were covering 4 bases, Homeland Security at Noble Eagle. Most of my time, like I said now, was all Fort Stewart, Georgia. And I was pretty much the driver for the colonel and the sergeant major, the battalion sergeant major. They had to go here or other bases or whatever. I did a lot of driving for them. Now,
what rank were you at this time?
Oh, I was just an E2 at the time. I come into National Guard as an E2, and it's like everybody forgot that I was even there with Noble Eagle, being mobilized. I'd been an E2 for over a year and a half in the National Guard. And, you know, E3 is an automatic rank. I just got skipped over. Somebody just missed the paperwork. But when somebody finally caught up to me and caught the paperwork, within 6 months, I was E4. So everything got straightened out, and I was E4. And then come the end of Noble Eagle, we were demobbing at Fort Stewart, or we were allowed to stay on at Fort Jackson for another year if we wanted. I took the option to go to Fort Jackson for the second year. But then 3 months after that, they demobbed us anyway. They said, well, we don't really need you guys. And so in first of 2004, into 2003, somewhere in there, I was finished with Noble Eagle.
So, that's what me and Brendan were talking about. You know, like when we were on National, when we were activated, you know, we got paid really good. You know, we got paid BAQ, BAH, all that good stuff. So, yeah. What was it like coming off of Noble Eagle and trying to go back into civilian life? How was your job still there for you? What kind of, was there a struggle there?
No, the company I worked for, at the time the company was named Willamette. It was a paper mill there from, Northern state of Washington, Oregon, excuse me, up that way. And they eventually sold out. It's actually a Canadian-owned company now. But at the time, I mean, they were big. They were they supported our military so much. As a matter of fact, Sergeant Major Elton worked there at the paper mill as well. So I had knew him prior to the National Guard. But there was quite a few National Guard folks that worked there in different units. And they were just real good to us. Now, let me say one thing. You guys at Fort Jackson, y'all were getting the BAH, the BAQ, and the extra pay. Us at Fort Jackson, we weren't getting all the extra. All we got was the BAQ. So, because they said we had we were living in a motel and not in barracks. So they were providing us with better housing. But anyway, nonetheless, transitioning back to civilian life wasn't hard. I mean, because basically we did not do a lot of – yeah, we were trained guard fences and my entrances and ammo points and different other things on bases, you know. But really, a terrorist attack against a military base wasn't – I'm not going to say it wouldn't happen, but after 9/11, I think we were far away from seeing too many more terrorist attacks away.
So what was your reaction when – we got the warning order in 2006 at our national training when we got the warning order for Afghanistan.
We were at...
what was that like? Because that's when it got real, right?
That's, you know, I expected it. I was waiting on it, and I didn't know. I always felt like, you know, South Carolina National Guard, especially our guard unit, the whole 263rd Armor, man, we had some guys that were just, I mean, we had some beasts, you know what I mean? We had some guys that were in shape. We had some guys that were outstanding marksmen. We had guys who they performed well. They checked every box, and I was wondering why we hadn't been activated already. I really was, but then when you start activating, you find people would. There were some people who had good excuses. There were some people who just had excuses, and Then you had, well, us guys that were ready to go. And then we had guys like you who was ready to go, and the Army kicked back. And, man, I know how you felt. No, I don't know how you felt. I could sympathize with how you felt. And I hate that you didn't go with us, brother. I wish you could have. I always liked you when I first met you, which I'd known you probably around 2002 or 2003 I first met you. Can't remember if I met you before Noble Eagle or right when we mobilized, but I hated this. There were guys that wanted to go that got kicked back, and there were guys that just whatever reason, one or another, and I forgive them all now. I have no hard feelings against anyone, but there were people who decided they didn't want to go. And then there were people who had jobs that they had to do in rear detection.
Now, were you married at this time?
I was still married to my first wife, and she was a wonderful lady. We got two kids together. We got two grandkids now. She did not understand why I was going to go on this trip, because we were told if you done Noble Eagle, you don't have to go on this. You can volunteer to go, but they weren't going to say, hey, you got to go to Afghanistan. But I think they knew pretty much that we were going to be there. For the most part, we were. And she was not liking it at all. And but I tried to explain to her, you know, it's duty, the honor. It was what I was supposed to do. She dealt with it, but she didn't like it.
Now, you know, Mahaney had so many glowing words for you and said you were one of the best NCOs that he's ever had. And he put you right up there with Command Sergeant Major Cheatham's. So that's pretty high. That's pretty high praise right there. So, and I consider you a great NCO. You know, I consider you one of my mentors. So now talk to us. You guys are locked, ready to rock, lock and loaded on the plane. What was it like touching down in Afghanistan?
Well, brother, thank you for the kind words. I do appreciate that. When we first touched down was, well, I'm not going to recover the whole story, but Mahaney laid it out pretty good. We stayed in Germany for a little over a week, and then we got to Kyrgyzstan, part of the old Mother Russia, and we were stuck there. And it was just so cold. We flew over at the end of December, 1st of January. I mean, it was just so cold, and the snow and ice everywhere. It was just hard getting in and out. But from Kyrgyzstan to Afghanistan, we were taking those military flights from then on. So we got there. I remember getting there. It was at nighttime. I really don't know if it was early morning or just late night. I remember getting there. I was tired, brother. I wanted to take a nap. But I was probably more scared that first week and a half than I'd ever been in my life. I wouldn't show it for anybody, but there was a fear running through me that I just could not. I mean, I was almost shaking, you know what I mean? And because you're hearing war stories, you hear the tales before you go, and then as soon as you get there, you got people meeting you at the getting off the plane, telling you their tales of woe. And then you come to find out most of these guys had been on secure bases the whole time and never got out in the country. And so the scary part was the stories, but the guys hadn't been through the scary part, which I'm sure we'll get to
now,
later
let me
on.
Ask you
but
a question, you know, because you know Mahaney, I think he was still a specialist, or he might have just got promoted to sergeant. What was it like you know, because I, when I became an NCO, I lived the NCO creed. I've always made sure that everybody was taken care of before me, and I was worried about everybody else. So what was it like being an NCO and having these E4s, E3s, and taking them outside of the wire and having and worrying about their safety and that they get to go home safe?
Well, here's the deal, brother. I was at the time when we were mobilized and everything we were doing and the way our teams were set up and squads and all, I was just a team leader. Our squad leader was an E6 who was, I was an E5 at the time, and our E6, Sergeant Wilson, a good guy. I'm not knocking the man for anything. The guy was, he was a nice guy, but he was probably early 50s. His knees were going bad. His shoulders weren't good. And he, I'm not going to say he wasn't capable of being a squad leader, but I will say that they probably should have, instead of putting the guy there and then having to remove him, because they had to remove him out of position before we mobilized. So when they moved him out of position, Lieutenant Broadway and Sergeant Cheatham, they came to me and promoted me to the position. Now, you know, the Army motto is, you know, the guy above you's role and you know the guy below you's role. So I was thrown into squad leader position 2 days before we flew to Afghanistan. So here I am, a young E5 doing an E6 role. And instead of responsible for three other guys, now I got two full teams. I got eight guys that I'm responsible for. And PCCs, PCIs, your combat checks, your combat inspections. Make sure you got plenty of ammo and you got plenty of water. And we can eat later. We can eat in 3 days, whatever. I mean, I just, that's the way I felt, you know. Keep hydrated, keep plenty of ammo, because we're going to come back alive. If we got to shoot everything down we see, we're coming back alive. That was the commitment I made to my guys, and that's really how I felt about it.
Talk to us about the day that, at the time that we lost Sergeant Philpott and Sergeant Bullard.
Okay. The thing about that was, I had my wife, like I said, at the time I was still married to my first wife. Early October, we just come back to our base. We were messing around, shooting some basketball, playing PT and all. And me and another guy collided, and he cracked a bone in my nose. So I had to leave from Turncow and go down to which was a little small base where run by the Dutch were running that base. We were just sitting there. We had a couple of pods there right outside the base there, where our crew was stationed. And I had to go to Kandahar, where they had a nice big hospital and all. So I get up there, and as soon as I get there, I get a phone call, which it was actually worked pretty well that I went to Kandahar, because they wouldn't have had to try to track me down to find me. My mother-in-law at the time passed away. So I was going home for emergency leave for her funeral and all of that thing. So I'm home, and the day before I leave to go back to Afghanistan, I'll never forget it. I was sitting on the couch at my mother-in-law's house. Well, my father-in-law and my wife was right beside me. And I don't remember what was on TV, but I remember Bob Juback of Channel 13 comes up on the TV and says, a local soldier killed in Afghanistan. I'm like, what? So this is on my mind as I'm heading back to Afghanistan. I'm catching the 4 o'clock out of Georgia trying to get back to Afghanistan, and I'm dealing with who got killed. And Brendan talked a lot about how the communications are supposed to stop when one of the guys are killed, and how things went wrong with Philpott. Well, I never even heard Philpott's name until I got back to Kyrgyzstan, and passing through one of the other guys from our unit, he was going home, a guy named Patrick Martin, and he was one who told me that it was Philpott. I said, man, I hate to hear that. I didn't know Philpott well, but Edward was one of them. From what I knew of him, he loved his family. He loved his little girls. Man, that dude was, I mean, he just loved his wife and he loved his kids. He loved his country, but he really loved them, and he wanted nothing more to make it home. And I mean, it hurt me when he died, you know. But I didn't hear this until 4 days later. And at the same time, that's when I passed Martin in Kyrgyzstan, he's asking me what happened to Romano, because he knew Louis Romano was one of my soldiers, was at my base. And, Romano got shot in the face by a sniper. My group had been out on a mission, and I was just coming back. And that's where he got shot in the face. And I said, man, I don't know. I hadn't heard anything. I said, I'm just coming back in. And he said, yeah, I heard he got shot. He said, I don't know how he's doing. So now I'm dealing with the death of Philpott, and hearing Romano's been shot, and I didn't know how bad he was, and the communications are down. I can't get in touch with nobody over the phone. So I finally get back in Afghanistan, and I find out Romano's good. He's hurt bad, but he's good. They'd already got him over to Germany, I think, by then. So, anyway, I get back to Kandahar Airfield, and I'm waiting for my flight out. I was at Bagram Airfield. I was sitting at Bagram Airfield because I was sitting at the Pat Tillman USO Memorial Building, and just waiting for my flight. It was right across from the flight line. I was waiting for my flight back to – I was going to fly into Kandahar, and then from Kandahar – to bus down to Terrencout, which is, like I said earlier, where I was stationed. And I'm sitting there at the Pat Tillman Memorial, and Sergeant Major Elwinton calls me. He said, boy, where you at? I figured he was just calling, making sure I was back, you know, in country, because my time was already up. I said, I'm back in country, Sergeant Major. I said, I just got back in. I said, I'm fixing to fly out from here, from Bagram down to Kandahar. I said, I should be there just a little bit to sign the paper. Well, little did I know, the reason the flights were delayed was because there was another attack on U.S. forces down that way. He said, well, there's something I got to tell you. He said, I'm not supposed to tell you right now, but I'm going to go ahead and tell you. He said, because I don't think you would tell it. He said, and I know how close you were. He said, but we lost another guy. I said, oh, man. I mean, my heart dropped, you know. He said, it was David Bullard. And I just, brother, I mean, from that day for the next couple of days, I was just in a haze. I don't remember a whole lot, but I remember they got me down to Kandahar, and I'm standing there waiting around. I'm looking for those guys, anybody that was with David, with Bullard. And I hear about Mahaney been shot in the head, and I didn't know how he was doing. And all of a sudden, this Humvee pulls up, like, right beside me, and Broadway jumps out of it, and he just comes up to me. Man, he just give me the biggest hug, and me and Broadway just sat there crying and hugging for about 5 minutes there. Looked like a couple little kids just – I don't know, man. It was so surreal. You know what I'm saying? And he's telling me the story about Mahaney, and said Mahaney's up at the hospital. Let's ride up there and look at him. So we go up there. Mahaney, I don't know if he remembers this, but I'll never forget. And I'm trying to make light of a bad situation, brother. No one out there feel hard at me, because this was a tough time for all of us. But Mahaney comes out, and this sergeant major, the guy's been shot in the head 4 times, people. His helmet is shattered and in pieces. There's no telling where his field cap was. All he had was a toboggan wearing on his head. Now, we're on a garrison post in country. You're supposed to have some type of cover on your head. And Mahaney's walking without any cover because he's leaving the hospital. And like I said, his helmet shattered. And this sergeant major of the post is jumping his ass because he didn't have a cover on. And it was just, man, it was the funniest thing. I guess you had to be there, brother. I'm not.
And I can just
flash your mood a little.
Mahaney just looking at him like, "Are you serious? you can't be serious right now."
He's like, "Man, I just got shot in the head 4 times. I'm sure he had a good concussion. His ears probably still ringing at the time, and this sergeant major yelling at him. But I digress. What can you do, brother? It was
how much longer did you stay in Afghanistan after that?
Okay, that was October. That day was October 30th. And man, let me tell you what, if you've never been, I think the worst thing in the world was the next formation when they're not there. And they're doing the honorary tributes to the fallen. And I was told I needed to get on back to my base. And I said, I'm not. I'm staying for Bullard's tribute. You couldn't have poured hot doo-doo on me and got me off of that base right then. I wasn't leaving until that was over.
You know, the difference between the National Guard and regular Army is, you know, a lot of us, you know, even though I was a Yankee that transplanted, you know, a lot of us, you know, we grew up together. You know, we knew, we went to funerals, we went to weddings, we went to barbecues, you know, everybody knew each other's mother. You seen each other in Walmart. It wasn't just like, you know, a regular Army where, you know, you serve with a guy and then you never see him again.
Yeah, you served next door to a guy for 3 years, and then one day he's PCS'd and you never hear from him again. You don't even know his last or his first name half the time. The only reason you know his last name is because it's on his uniform. But to me, you were Rich. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I was Jody, Brendan. We were to one another. We weren't just Sergeant Stubbs or Sergeant Kaufman. We were literally out in the field, out in life. I knew David Bullard. I mean, he was He worked at the local food line. I seen him all the time. And I run into him. I mean, you're talking about a guy I seen 3-4 times a week. Yeah. Been to his house. You know what I'm saying? And, I was one of the guys. I had a family and all, and my kids were young at the time. So a lot of the guys didn't bother me. They would come over, but it wasn't like they were bothering me because they knew I had family, the young kids and stuff like that. And I helped guys as much as I could. They helped me as much as they could. But, you know, the ones with the younger kids, you kind of give them a little more space because they still raising kids. But you were still – we still done things together. Like you said, we barbecued together. We would see each other in Walmart. We were friends, man. We were more than just guys like, in the same know, unit.
When you guys got home, and you demobed and you went back to your units, you know, what was that like? Because I know, like, when I mean, because I didn't go to Afghanistan, obviously, but I know when we got off Noble Eagle, it seemed like it became fractured. There was your Jackson guys. There was your Fort Stewart guys. It didn't seem like a family anymore. And a lot of people, I'm not mentioning any names because I'm not about that. They were just covering their own asses. What was it like coming home? And because, you know, there are some people that we lost, and I'm not going to mention any names because, you know, I respect them, but you know, they lost their lives eventually to alcoholism, you know, drank themselves to death. And we know who we're talking about. But is that when you got home, is that when the proverbial shit hit the fan?
When I got home, I'm going to say for about 5 or 6 months, I put on a good mask, you know. I lived in the world, and I just said, hey, everything's good. You know what I mean? I was having sleepless nights. I was doing a lot of staying up, looking at the ceiling. And what I'd done was I let it brew inside of me. You know what I mean? I didn't vent to anyone. I didn't talk to anyone. I just let the stuff brew inside of me. And like you said, the fracture happened. So a lot of guys that were at Gordon, I wasn't friends with as close with anymore. I'm not going to say I wasn't friends with because I was still friends with them. But we weren't as close anymore. When we stepped off the field, off the plane at Fort Stewart, or the bus at Fort Stewart, we actually flew into Hunter Army Airfield and then bus to Fort Stewart. Got on the parade grounds, and me and maybe 8 or 9 other guys, we were told we were going straight to McCrady Training Center for PODC, which is
Primary Leadership Development Course. Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm trying to think. Warrior Leader Course is what it's called now. Yeah. But so here we are. I mean, we get one night, we could go to dinner with a family. They look at me, they said, don't have nothing to drink. You're leaving in the morning. And they were serious. And so we went out. My family drove all the way to Georgia and then had to turn around and go home without me. Because I had to get on the bus. And I mean, we argued and we complained. And when I tell you this was a surprise on us, it was. We did not know this was coming. Justin Strickland, you know Justin well. He was one of us that had to go. He just finally dropped out the course. He just said, screw it. I'm done. I'm going home. I'm not putting up with it. I'm not doing this.
Because this is interesting to me. You spend 2 years in Afghanistan, going to PLDC, and they start teaching you this stupid shit, you know, because I went to back then, but, you know, land nav, but it was stuff that you did in real life to where the people that were teaching you, you could have taught the course, and half of the time they were never even deployed or mobilized. So I'm sure that had to, like they say in the South, stick in your craw a little bit.
Well, I'm going to put it like this. The two instructors that I had, they recognized it right away. They, they gave me high marks on everything. I walked out of PODC as the honor graduate from that whole course out of 190 students. I had the highest average in the whole course. But they recognized it right away. I don't know if the rest of the school recognized the rest of the instructors, but my two instructors did. Okay.
So what was that like graduating and then coming home?
So then that was over. So now I finally come home. And like I said, for five, six months, everything was great. And then anger that was already inside me started boiling up to the surface, brother. I was mad David was gone, Bullard. I was mad Sergeant Philpott was gone, Edward. I was mad Romano was hurt. I was mad Mahaney was hurt. You know, these were – and three of those guys were all in my platoon, our mobilization. They were in my platoon. Two of the severely hurt and one killed come from my platoon. So our third platoon was real close. We had, like, you heard Mahaney talk so much about Sergeant Cheatham, man. And Sergeant Cheatham used to tell you, he meant it. He was the standard, and he wasn't lying. The guy was 6'3", 180 pounds, just lean. He could run a four-minute mile. I mean, not that fast, but he could smoke the PT test. You know what I'm saying? He walked the walk, but all the talk that he gave, he could back it up.
You know, like a lot of people don't realize that it's the times at night when you're sitting there in bed looking at the ceiling, thinking about all the what ifs or the I should haves. Is that what ate you up inside?
When it come to Bullard, yeah, it should have been me. I had that. I let that survivor's guilt get me for the longest time, and even now I feel like it should have been me. The guy had just had a newborn baby. Right before I was coming home for emergency leave for my mother-in-law passing, Bullard and them were up there at Kandahar, and he's like, hey, man, go see the baby. Go see the baby since you got to go home. I had to finally tell him I would so he would shut up about it. You know what I'm saying? And I told him, I said, yeah, man, I'll swing by and I'll see the baby. I didn't want to bother his wife, Amber, who was a lovely woman. I love her to death. I think the world of her. And I just didn't want to bother her because she just had a kid. She's already without her husband. He's in Afghanistan. They were newly married. You know, their honeymoon was spent with the 2 weeks lead that we had going to, you know, from Mississippi before we shipped out to Afghanistan. That was their honeymoon. So I didn't want to be the guy that was going to go bother her, but I told him to appease him because he was so proud of his son, ma'am. And he only got to hold him like one day, you know, before he had to come back to Afghanistan. And I said, yeah, Dave, I'll go by there and see her. I said, I'll go see her one day before I come back. And, but I knew in my mind I wasn't going to do it. I was telling him that. And then the day I get back, you know, I get the news that he's been killed, and I felt like a dirt bag. You know what I mean, Rich? I was so I lied to the guy the last time I seen him. I felt so low, and I felt like, man, I should have been there instead of him. And that survivor's guilt hit me hard, brother. And so during the next couple of years, I guess I just mourned it. Outwardly mourned it. I started showing out. I started drinking heavily. This is late 2008. You know, I started getting in trouble for my drinking. Okay. I got arrested one time, but the cop couldn't prove I was driving because I was out of the car, out of the vehicle. So he could only arrested me for DUI, but it didn't stick. I got lucky, so it was only a reckless driving charge. The judge couldn't let a DUI stick because he did not see me driving the car, did not see me behind the wheel. And I wasn't going to tell on myself, so, you know
by,
what I mean?
By 2013, you've been married twice, divorced twice, and then you became homeless. And this, you know, I consider you, you know, for me, you know, you're a hero. And I consider Mahaney a hero. But both you guys ended up homeless. Now, was it because of the drinking or was this everything out of control?
I look back now and I see how much different I could have done things. When I tell you I started getting out of control with my drinking and all, well, then the womanizing started. I started running around on my wife, my first wife, and I met my second wife. I run around on my wife with her, and she was married at the time, so neither one of us were up to any good. And we say we were in love with one another, but I think we were more in lust with one another. And we ended up with a child from that relationship, but we broke up before we got married. Okay. And so me and her broke up, and here I am with no place to go. And my first wife, who I'm divorced from, she actually let me move back in her house and sleep on her couch for a few weeks anyway. And I found this is 2009. I found me an apartment over in Florence, South Carolina. I was moving in. The day I was moving in was December 7th, 2009. And I got my daughter with me, my oldest daughter. She was, 12, 13 at the time, something like that. And she was with me. And her mama calls and she said, take Misty to my sister's house and drop her off, and I need you to come by here. Me and you have something to talk about. I was like, oh boy, she's going to want back rent or something, you know, for me sleeping on a couch. And so I get to her house, and she said, come on with me. We got to go to the hospital. Your brother's been in a wreck. And I'm sorry, brother. I thought I'd be all right. I'm good.
And the thing is, I remember this day. What an effect. And I want you to, you know, this is, it's all, because some people right now that's listening to this, there's one person out there that's struggling today. And that's what this is all about, brother. This is what the Lord sent you through me today to talk to that one person. So tell us your story.
Okay. So my brother, this was my baby brother now. We get to the hospital and I go in the emergency room. I didn't, my ex-wife was not telling me everything. She was just telling me he was in a bad wreck and it was pretty serious. Little did I know at the time, she already knew, but she didn't tell me. So I'm up at the emergency room talking to the lady at the mirror, and she's like, "Sir, we don't have a Eric Stubbs here." She said, "Hold on just a second. Let me go check real quick. Maybe there's something else." And so she comes back, and then another lady comes walking out the door from behind, and she walks up to him, and she says, "Sir, come with me." So I thought maybe they found him. She's going to take me back there where he's at. But she takes me back to the quiet room in the back of the hospital, and I said, "Oh, boy." And she just sets me in there. Me and my ex-wife are sitting in there, and nobody's telling me anything. And it seemed like days, brother. It seemed like days. Well, it turned out it was probably just 30 minutes, maybe. My mom shows up. My older brother shows up. My dad shows up with his preacher. My mom and dad are divorced now. They were divorced at the time. So we're all sitting in this quiet room. Here comes two patrolmen and a female doctor who was, the one in charge of the hospital at that time, that night. And anyway, not to point fingers at anyone, I'm not mad at anybody, but there were some people who thought, you know, well, he's been to Afghanistan, he should let him go see him, let him see his body. They had done told us he was dead. He had perished. And they were saying that they would have to send the body off for autopsy. I think they said they would send him up to Chapel Hill for an autopsy. Now this is something that's in my brain, brother, that I'll never get out. It's stuck there. All the bad things I saw in Afghanistan, you know, the blood and other stuff. You know, I saw a lot of it over there. We saw a lot of action where I was, and nothing hit me harder than the night of December 7th, 2009. This nurse, pardon me, ma'am, if you're listening. It was a doctor. I don't remember her name. She was back there. She took me back, and she said, "No, Mr. Stubbs, I'm going to tell you now." She said, "You don't understand how bad your brother's body is burnt." She said we had to put him in two body bags. That's how bad he was. Okay? And so I go in there, and I mean, they open this body bag, and I got a black dog. He was blacker than my dog was. That's how, I mean, and I'm talking head to toe. Other than like a 2-inch space on his wrist where you could actually see skin. And my brother had a flame tattoo on his wrist, and you could see the flame on his wrist. And I was like, "Oh my God." I knew it was him. I could tell by the facial structure, although it was all burnt and all the skin was gone, hair was gone, everything was gone. I could tell it. And I said, "Let me ask you one thing. He only had part of his arm was there. The rest of it was his other arm. It had fell off. It burnt through, I guess you'd say. I don't know. I said, was there some metal pins in his? She said, sir, that's the one thing I was waiting on. She said, you tell me that, I won't send him off for an autopsy because she said, you're pretty sure. I said, I'm 100% sure that's him. She said, yeah, the metal from his legs where he was, when he was a child, he had been run over by a car and they had to put metal in his leg to set his leg again because he broke both legs when he was hit by a car.
Now, after this, did this send you into a deeper spiral?
Yes. That was, that right there, I went home and, man, I started drinking. And, brother, I didn't quit drinking for 7 years after.
You gotta tell me, because, you know, for people that are listening to this, I'm a recovering drug addict, recovering alcoholic, 32 years sober. What was the final moment where you said, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired? And what was that come to Jesus moment?
Okay. Well, 30 years I went on and I done divorced, married and divorced the second time. Which drinking had a lot to do with that. And I even started using pain pills a lot. So I was, Rich, I bought a cooler specifically to sit beside my bed. So if I would wake up in the middle of the night, I would have beer in the cooler and I wouldn't have to walk to refrigerator.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
You're preaching to the choir, bro.
This is how bad I was drinking, bro. Oh yeah. Well, you know what I'm saying. But every dime I had, I went from 180 pounds of, I was lean, in shape, I was doing good. But I went from 180 pounds to about 130 pounds of just pure bones. And I met my wife that I'm married to now. This is the third marriage, but she was my saving grace, man. I met her in a bar, but she had quit drinking because she wanted to take care of me because she knew how bad I was. And she had lived a hard lifestyle herself through the years, and so she was very familiar with PTSD and the tragedies that I had went through and everything. And my oldest brother called me one day, said, how about going to church with me? You know, I was raised in church, but by now I'm having a lot of struggles with Christianity, with any religion, anything religious. I got to almost where I didn't believe anymore. You know what I'm saying? But so we went to church one day, and we started going pretty regular. And then one Sunday morning, we got up, we went to church. We left church. I said, take me by the bar. I'm going to drink. I was just having a rough day, and now, I'd already attempted suicide twice by then. One time, I think I was trying to see if I would do it. But the second time when I tried it, I thought, man, I'm just going to do it, get it over with, and it's going to be over with. And I couldn't. I just couldn't finish doing it. You know what I mean? I wanted to, but I couldn't. The Lord spared me. And so I went to church that morning. We left. I went to the bar. I don't remember the whole day. My wife remembers it a lot better. She was sober. But I told her to come and get me. I said, I had to change. I said, something's got to change. I knew that something had to change or I was going to be dead. And that day was January 4th, 2015. I went back to church that night, and I that was a Sunday night, Sunday evening. And I give my heart to the Lord that day. And ever since then, I've not touched another drop. I've put it aside. And I've even had doctors tell me, said, you don't quit drinking. You have to wean yourself off of drinking when you an alcoholic like you were. My liver had enlarged that it was all the way across my stomach. That's how enlarged my liver was. That's how bad I had gotten. But I quit and, you know, and never touched another drop, brother.
Because you posted on Facebook that you said, that's it, I'm done. I'm not drinking anymore. And that's when we started going back and forth, you know. So, and that's when I think our relationship really started to take off.
Well, see, that was one thing about you that I never knew. I never knew you were in recovery. I mean, I thought you were a good guy. I thought you, you know, you were one of the boys, but I never knew that you were a recovering alcoholic as well. But until then, and then that's when we really connected on another level. You're right. We really
now
did.
Tell you us reached because, out. You know, now you're remarried. You got a beautiful bride. You're raising three girls that aren't even your own. Please talk about that. Because, you know, some people think that, you know, like they say, you know, when you get into recovery or when you start changing your life, that you stop living for yourself and you start living for others. So talk to us about that,
right,
that change and now how you're having these little beautiful babies around you all the time.
Okay. Early 2018, I'm not going to belittle anyone, but these girls, their dad is my wife's nephew. And him and their mom, which he didn't have custody, she did, but they both had struggles. They've had the way they grew up and the life they live in, they were dealing with things, and they had made bad turns in life. Not bad people, just bad decisions. And so it come to one day, DSS.
Well, and, you know, I think that's such a blessing that you're able to be there. And, you know, God is really working in your life, you know?
Hey, man, I'm sorry. I lost connection for a second. I apologize.
It's okay. So, you know, I think that's just such a blessing. And then it's funny, you know, one day I'm scrolling through Facebook and then I see you're running for some local government job. Talk to us about that.
Anyway, I don't know. How much did you hear about the girls? I don't know if you heard much, but we went up there. DSS was involved and we ended up with three of my wife's great nieces. And they've been with us 3 years now. And it's like I got another chance to help these kids get their life together. Now they're all honor roll students. They're doing well. And I'm so proud of them. I love them death like they were my own. They are mine. You know, they still have a mom and dad, and they know that. But they're still mine now. But anyway, I'm back at home in Macau, and I'm thinking, man, we could change some things around here. And I decided to run for local councilman here after I let the mayor talk me into it a little bit. And I did. I won. And I think a lot to say I made a difference in the community some. And I had no intentions of running for a second term. But once again, the mayor, he convinced me to go ahead and run. And so I run a second term without really politicking. and I was tied with the, I mean, literally deadlock vote. We were tied. We had to have a runoff, and the guy won the runoff. It wasn't that I didn't want to help others, because I did. I was working food banks. I was helping people. I would deliver meals to the elderly. I was running errands for people. And I'm not tooting my own horn. I'm not bragging about anything I've done. I just felt like I didn't have to be on the town council to do it. I felt like I could do it a little more privately, where people wouldn't see or pay attention to everything I was doing. You get what I'm saying?
Oh, you know, and I totally get it. And, you know, even God said, you know, yeah. Even the Lord says that, you know, what you do in private makes more of a difference than what you do in
public. And I was more, as a councilman, more people were seeing it. And I thought, well, I just kind of didn't like it that way. And so I'm kind of glad I lost the runoff, because that way I didn't have to worry about people watching everything I was doing. I wasn't under the public eye as much. But, you know, I still wanted to help my people in my hometown.
And, you know, recovery is amazing. You know, like last week I went to dinner with one of the local judges. And, you know, and a couple friends of mine are all mayors of towns. And here's this guy that was so afraid of having to stand in front of a judge, you know, for being such a screw up. Now I'm going to dinner with judges. It's amazing what recovery can do. So talk to us a little bit about what you're doing now, and tell us how, you know, what a day in the life of Joey.
Okay. Well,
today.
You know, I had a couple of incidents in Afghanistan. I had broke a few bones, the terrain was so bad over there, and I think I was one of the clumsy ones. I just couldn't get my feet under me. So between the few physical deformatories I got from there and the mental aspect, you know, I started going through the VA, and I finally got VA service-connected disability through the VA. And I recently said, with the girls going back to school, you know, the coronavirus has, you know what it's done to the world. We don't need to talk about that. But I started a new job. I said, I'm just get out and work a part-time job, see how I like it, get back in the work field. And I went to work for Walmart. Believe it or not, they are a big-time supporter of the military. They hire veterans. They love hiring veterans. And I can't speak well enough of them. I used to think they were one of the big, you know, conglomerates who were just trying to push everybody out of business, but they help veteran communities, especially down and out veterans, believe it or not. They're real big on that. But
so, you know, I messaged you and I said, you know, what is your goal for being on the podcast? And, you know, we were talking about the 22 and the 16 soldiers that commit suicide every day. So what can we do to help bring those numbers down to zero? What kind of resources?
Well,
are out there
we all know the helpline. 253 help. They're the veterans. There's a veterans option for it. But, you know, as veterans, there's something about us guys, and you know what I'm talking about. There's something in us that says we can't just talk to anybody. I don't know why, but we don't work well just talking to anyone. They don't know what we've been through. You know what I'm saying? That's how we are. Yeah. So we have to look out for one another. And now I'm going to give a shout out to a certain young lady. Her name's Sheena. Marcano, and if I hope I'm pronouncing that right. If I'm said your name wrong, baby, please forgive me. I love you anyway. But you know, a few years back, I was in a bad place, and she reached out to me, and she just started talking to me. And she understood. She's a combat veteran. She'd been there. She knew. She just talked me off the ledge. You know what I'm saying? And then there's been other guys, Bo Rouse, one of my dearest friends in the world. I love him to death. He's come and got me a few times. He said, "Hey, man, let's take a ride. Let's go have a beer." Now, this was back in my drinking days, and he knew drinking wasn't the best thing for me, but he knew sometimes taking me for a beer was better than letting me kill myself, too. You know what I mean? And it looked out for me a few times. Mahaney was, he was kind of MIA on me for a while, man. I didn't realize that I did not know he was having such a hard time, although I should have, but I wasn't keeping in touch with him no more than he kept in touch with me, you know. I just kind of felt bad about it, but he was in a rough place too, and I did not, that was one thing I didn't realize. There were other guys who were hurting just as well. We have to look out for one another. If you're out there and you're listening to this and you're thinking about ending your life, there's help. Call us, email one of us, hit us up on Facebook, send us a message, say, "Hey, can you help me out a little bit? I'm hurting. I need some resources." We can find you resources. There are Jeremy Reyes, another one of the great guys, my brother, I love him to death. He's found a few places that he works with or has worked with. That's and you, Mr. Coffin, let me tell you, people, if you don't know the guy, look him up, find him on Facebook, find him on Instagram, whatever, follow his podcast, listen to his The Comeback Coach, man. He's got a great story to tell. He's even written a book. You guys kick in and check out his story. Kaufman wasn't the red hot NCO that he turned out to be. He was
hell no. I told everybody.
He was one of the bad ones too. We all had our bad times, but he was a bad one for a while. But he's a great guy, and he can help us. He can help you guys. If you're out there listening, just know taking your own life is not worth it. There are resources. There's even help financially out there. You just have to be patient, and you have to be willing to look, and you have to ask for it. People don't know you're hurting if you're not asking.
Amen. Amen, brother. Well, I want to thank you so much. I want to thank everybody for listening. If this show affected you, please leave a comment on our on Apple. Just let them know that we're trying to save lives. Guys, if you love coffee, definitely check out Soldier Girl Coffee. Great tasting coffee. And you will not, and it's veterans, a veteran-owned company that is giving veterans jobs. So it's 100% veteran, 100% of the time. Jody, brother, I love you so much. I'm so grateful for you. And I'm so grateful that you're in my inner circle and that I can always talk to you whenever I'm feeling down.
Hey, I love you, man. Thank you for your time, for allowing me to be here to tell my story a little bit. And
this will go out in a couple of weeks, so and I'll let you know what it is, and then I'll
thank post you,
it everywhere. And
love you, man.
I love you. Have a beautiful week,
love
brother.
You, brother.
Love you.
Thank you for joining us today. Please hit subscribe and share. Please feel free to leave us a comment.